That was a pretty good summary of the book, actually, I thought. I feel sort of relieved, no matter what I say, now the book's already summarized.
Yeah, we do have the book in the...
You don't have the book by copy here. The book, you might not know what the book is, so I don't, my copy's on the electronic version. So there's this book called, I call it Lord Wears the Women, but the technical title is God Wears the Women. And it's by Mother Silvana Vlad, who was a nun in Romania and passed away maybe 2018 or something like that, says in the book. So if you read the book, that's great. I'm not going to try to repeat what's in the book. She's more free association than I am, which is says a lot. But there are certain themes that kind of resonate with me, and I wanted to spend more time reading the book. And if I spoke on something else, I would have had to work on something else. And so it's totally selfish that I decided to want to talk about the book. And I think the plan, if I get a watch or something out here, is repeat for about 40 minutes. And then and we'll have discussion, and have a little break, and then another 40 minutes or so in discussion. But I'm all the happier if you interrupt me, if there's something that's not clear or you have something you want to say. If you've read the book, you don't need to have read it, but if you've read Mother Silvana, then there'll be things that stood out to you that didn't stand out to me. You're welcome to bring those up. It's okay. Happy to have that contribution as well. Okay? So, where to begin? So I think we should begin, I won't follow through literally through the book or even try to summarize it in that sort of way, but she begins in the first lecture with prayer teaches us, and I think a good place for us to start is what does she mean by that? She never explains it, she never uses that phrase again in the rest of the book. That means I'm free to tell you whatever I want. So there's a couple things we can say about that. The first is there's at least two different types of learning. There's, you know, like you could study music theory and think like, well, okay, this is great. I know all this music theory, now let me play the piano. It wouldn't have helped at all, right? It just wouldn't help. You could study pianos and the length of the strings and the tension and the size, and that'd be great, but you sit down at the piano, you're still not going to be very good at it. Because to play the piano, you have to play the piano. To get good at the piano, you have to play the piano. And so there's things that are sort of knowledge, head knowledge, whatever, abstractions, theory, whatever you want to call it. And then there's skills. So riding a bike is a skill. You can learn about how bikes are put together, but it's not going to help you ride a bike. You have to learn because it's a matter of balance and things like that. And so when she says prayer teaching us, pre-teaches us, I think at the first level, there's like, well, prayer teaches us how to pray because you have to pray to do it. Skill, prayer, you can read a lot of, you've read a lot of books on prayer. and I'm sorry to tell you this, but it's not clear that it makes you better at praying. It certainly doesn't make you better at praying unless you pray. And it's not that you can't learn things, like, you know, maybe learning some music theory really does assist your, facilitate your learning how to play playing the piano, but you still have to play the piano. You still have to pray. And so I think part of the emphasis on this title, Prayer Teaches Us, is that we learn by doing, and in general, not just prayer, but the whole Christian life is really, it's a skill, it's a way of life, it's a life lived, it's a practice, it's not a body of information. You can have all the information that you want in your head, and it's not going to change you just because it's in your head. Father Roman used to say that the Last Judgment isn't a theology test. And so you have to do it. some of you are relieved that it's a theology test, but not a theology test. Others of you wish it were because you don't practice it. Whether it's fasting, I'm sorry, but I sort of think that in the Christian life we think that it's just like supposed to come easy and we just know how to do it. And fasting is just not eating, and prayer is just saying some words, and repentance is just going to confession or something like that. And I think my own sense is that we get sort of comfortable with a kind of a murky, nonchalant, apathetic Christian life, kind of mediocre, you know, like lukewarm, put it in Jesus' words. And we just sort of get comfortable there, and we never really move on. And if we're gardening is another skill. we would notice that the worms are eating our vegetables and the aphids are attacking and the deer are coming and the whatever, you know, like we would notice it and we'd be like, whoa, I have to do something about this, or we would just give up and say, forget it. But it would be like, but in our own Christian life, it seems like we are able to sort of enter into this sort of mediocre phase, at least at periods of time, and not really engage or push ourselves in this sort of way. And so I think that we have to realize that certain things don't come, as it were, naturally. They have to be practiced. When you were born, you could, unless things didn't go right, didn't go well, when you were born, you could breathe and your heart beat, and that's all involuntary, that just happens. But you learn to walk by, well, first you learn to roll over or crawl or whatever, and then walk, and you had to practice that. You learned the language, you had to practice that, and people were patient with you and helped teach you and things like that. So I think the first thing that she's trying to get to us is we have to pray. We want to get good at praying, we have to pray. Unfortunately, there's a problem that comes to us immediately, is because you can't learn how to play the piano without playing, but it turns out you can't learn how to be a poor piano player without playing. If you don't play the piano, you're just not a piano player. It's not that you're bad at it, you're just not a piano player. If you don't pray, you're just not a prayer. It's not that you're bad at it, you just don't pray. So to get bad at something, you have to do it too, so that's the catch. Okay. Yeah. So you can play the piano and develop really bad habits. I use that all the time because I never learned how to play the piano. I gave up after 6 months in fourth grade. But I played a lot of golf, and I played with a lot of golfers, and some of which have unbelievably bad habits for decades, just decades, and still seem to be surprised that they hit the same bad shots time and time again. They have really grooved bad habits. And some of us have pretty grooved bad habits with prayer or fasting or repentance or whatever. We're just in a certain kind of rhythm. We get used to it. And we can go out to the golf course and have fun with our bad habits. And we can sort of, you know, kind of live the Christian life. But they're really kind of bad habits. And we're frustrated. And we say things like, I've been confessing this for 20 years or 40 years. And I'm still the same way. I'm still angry. Or I'm still envious. Or I'm still gossiping or whatever it is. And if there's been no change in 40 years, something's just like that. Something's not right, you know. We're not supposed to spend our time evaluating ourselves if something's not right. So that's the catch, is that prayer teaches us, but we have to do it, we have to do the activity in the right way to develop a good habit. Develop a bad habit by doing it in the wrong way. You have to develop a good habit by doing things in the right way. And that's why I think Mother Silwana, not so much didactically, but by an endless set of illustrated examples from her own life and the people that teaching that gave her, give us all these little bits of guidance on some of the right ways to pray. And really, I think in a way, the whole book, much of the book, could be seen as advice on how to pray. So I'll focus on it here at the beginning for a few minutes, and then we'll sort of weave it in and out as the time goes on. There's just some seats here too in the middle. Okay, so he never again after the title says prayer teaches us, but she does frequently say, on several occasions she says that Christ teaches her or teaches us, and the Holy Spirit teaches us. Okay, so that's part of what she means by prayer teaches us, is that we learn from Christ. The reason we're praying is we want to learn from Christ. We want to learn from the Holy Spirit. So it's not just, it's sort of like, yeah, so when I became Orthodox, I was wanting to get a lot of attention from my priest, so I was always complaining. And when I started serving in the altar, and I was a reader and a subdeacon, and I kept wanting more from him, and he just kept telling me, the altar teaches you. He just kept telling me, the altar teaches you. And then when I came here, that was when I was down in New Hampshire, and I came here, I was asking Father Roman advice, and he said, the altar will teach you. I said, oh, I think that this must be what God has for me. But that's really what Mother Silwana is saying, is that God will really teach you in the context that you're in. If you're serving in the altar, he'll teach you in that context. If you're singing in the choir, he'll teach you in that context. If you're raising children, he'll teach you in that context. And it's concrete, it's pragmatic, it's not abstract and removed, okay? And so when she says prayer teaches us, she really means Who am I to say what she really means? You get what I mean. She really means Christ, the Holy Spirit, they're teaching us in the context of praying. And so that's an invitation to listen. And so now we know immediately that prayer isn't just uttering words. We can say our prayers or we can pray our prayers. That's a big difference. You can sort of speak words into outer space with no attentiveness to Christ being present and no really kind of listening or noticing what's going on in your own life or really even being petty. It's just check box, okay, did my prayers, check box, did more prayers, and check box again. And then, but that's not praying, that's not learning. It's just like saying words. And we've been in conversations with each other like that, you know. We're sitting down and talking, and this person's clearly in a different space. You're really not paying attention to me at all. This is not a conversation. And sometimes our prayers are like that. And so Mother Silwan is saying prayer teaches us because we're talking to the creator of the universe, and he's responding. And he's the one teaching us. And so, you know, we say the Lord's Prayer a lot in the Orthodox Church, the Lord's Prayer a lot. But we ought to say something that you might call the disciples' prayer a lot. And that's, Lord, teach us to pray. That's in the Gospel of Luke, the request that the, you know, the disciples were talking to Jesus, and Jesus is God, so that's a prayer. And that's the prayer from the disciples that introduced Jesus giving us the Lord's Prayer. and so we should say, and so I know it's not good to talk about myself, but I do that anyway, sorry. I pray several times a day, Lord, teach me to pray. And always first thing in the morning, I do it in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, Lord, teach me to pray. And then I'll do whatever prayers I'm doing, but that's it. And I try to do that as many times as I can during the day. And of course, I recommend that. I think that's what we want to learn from. And that's what Mother Silwan is emphasizing repeatedly, and this, that she was getting this guidance from a priest, Galavia, Galavia. And he just kept telling, he wouldn't answer her questions, right? He just said, pray, go pray. And it's hard to actually come to think that God's really going to answer your questions in love. Well, God doesn't answer me. Well, the psalmist says God doesn't answer me a lot. That's a common thing in the psalms. And why aren't you answering me? Why aren't you there? Hear me when I pray to you. You're not listening to me. My God, why have you forsaken me? Nobody cares for me. Nobody cares for my soul. I look to the left, I look to the right, nobody's there. Nobody. So this is common, but that's the context in which we're being purified so that God can actually respond to us in a way so that we're not just, you know, kind of projecting onto him or getting, prayer's all about getting what we want, whatever it might be. So we're asking the beginning, the content, the first prayer might be just, Lord, teach me to pray, and to say that often and to really mean it and really believe that he'll teach us. Of course, we have to show up. You can go to a great piano teacher and say, teach me to play the piano, and then just never show up for lessons, and we didn't even say the words. So, you know, you have to go and you have to pray and you have to try. But just like gardening, like if you plant the stuff and it's not working right, you go talk to somebody, you find something out, you're just relentless. Like if you really want things to get better, there's areas in your life that you're just kind of tenacious. Like, this is not working out. I'm not going to be satisfied with mediocre. I'm just going to figure this out. Like, I'm going to watch 100 YouTube videos to figure this out, whatever it is, you know. But you're going to, like, if you really want to learn it, you're not going to stop until you find something that clicks. It doesn't mean everybody else was wrong or they gave you guidance or whatever, but maybe from God's point of view, you weren't quite ready until you had this sort of tenaciousness, or I think of it as desperation. And again, if you think of the examples, if you've read the book, you think of the examples that Mother Silwana gives, she really got in her place to where she was quite desperate. She has these funny phrases, like, you know, she grew up in this town where, can't remember now exactly how she puts it, but something like, people were skilled at turning happiness into unhappiness. And so she has these really funny turns of phrases where you're just like, I was very good at being unhappy and things like that. But there's this point where we reach rock bottom and we're basically desperate and we're really proud. And if you think of all of the examples in the Gospels, the miracles and the people who are interacting with Jesus, the one thing they have in common isn't a particular type of ailment, it's that they're desperate. desperate for themselves, desperate for their daughter, desperate for their son, whatever it is. They're just desperate. Desperate for their friend, who they're going to climb up on a roof, pull off the roof, and drop the guy down in front of them. Like, that's desperate, you know. And so I think Mother Silwana exhibits that or illustrates that in her own life, but also in sort of what she expects of other people, to be relentless. And this relentlessness is driven by this desperation. Nothing else matters. And that's driven by a repeated refrain of hers, which is only God can truly heal us. We can get like super, we can put band-aids on broken bones, but we can take aspirin for pain that is going to be, you know, chronic. We can solve problems in short periods of time by looking in other avenues, but to really be healed deep within our souls, then we need God. And if we really believe that, well, I guess it's a little bit like I was saying in the homily this morning, it's going to be a matter of whom we really follow. And if we really believe that God's the only one that can truly heal us, then we'll follow him, and we'll do it with this sort of relentlessness and desperation. And we'll learn by doing. We'll really learn from God. And other people, books and advice and talks and whatever it is, will be helpful. But if you always have the mindset that it's God who's teaching you, you won't get into this trap that is very common. People sometimes come here and they're pretty discouraged about their spiritual life and they can't figure out why. And I've now learned that the first question to ask them is, what are you reading? Yeah, well, my neighbor, it's almost always, unless they've already heard me give this illustration, I'm reading St. Paisios and St. Porphyrios and Elder Porphyrios, and then go this long list, and I always say the same thing, well, that's why you're depressed. Like, it really is. And you really think you got to live that way. You got to live like, did St. Paisios live like St. Porphyrios? No, they didn't live the same place. They lived a totally different life. Were either one of those married with kids? You know, did either one of those have a mortgage? You just get real. And so you can really be self-destructive by trying to be pious. And that's just not very helpful. Because you're learning from books instead of from Christ. Christ won't say, do 3,000 prostrations in the middle of the night every night. In all likelihood, he won't. And if he does, great, go do it. But it's really unlikely. Okay, for most of you, that's just not where your life is. And so you read those books and you think you have to do everything that every one of them did without ever noticing that what's really going on in those books is that they lived their life like Mother Silwana did, which was in communion with Christ and being guided by the Holy Spirit and experiencing this freedom and just sort of following day by day in the most little and trivial ways. And if you really look at their lives, it's shocking how trivial the most important things are. They just pray and simple things like, oh Lord, I'm kind of discouraged today. And like, that turns out to make a saint out of you if you pray like that. But you know, if I have to do 1,000 prostrations a night or something like that, it's like, well, that's too much, you know, and I get discouraged and overwhelmed or whatever. And so this ways in which God will teach us will be unique to each of us. But it will really be Christ teaching us, and we'll make lots of mistakes, but it's okay. We fell a lot of times before we learned how to walk. And we fell a lot of times, I fell several times learning how to ride a bike, once in a pricker, pricker bushes. And my brother was riding me on a bike, and I put my foot in the spokes, and I got it broken in 3 spots. My leg was like, last time I rode a bike, last time I rode on the handlebars of a bike. So, you know, all kinds of terrible things have happened to us in our lives, you know, but we keep on going. And we, you know, if we really care, again, if we're tenacious, if we're desperate, if we really want, we'll move forward. We won't give up. We won't let those things like that discourage us. But we'll be looking to Christ. Okay? We might read a book. We might go talk to a priest or a spiritual father or mother, whatever it might be, visit a monastery, go on a retreat. But in the end, we're looking for information from Christ. I'm sorry I'm beating this over and over, but she beats it over and over, and that's why you're here. That's the most important thing. If you don't get this theme and you don't put it into practice, nothing else matters. It's just a bunch of information. Pray wearily, pray relentlessly, and with great desperation that you want God to bring about something, a particular change in you. And and it's learned in practice from him. Okay. That was a lot. Now, I think I should go, I have two different directions to go and I can't go to both places at the same time, so figure out which is the best way to go. We have to pray honestly. I've already alluded to this. So Mother Silvana talks about in passing at different times praying the prayers of the church, praying the knock at sister, praying morning or evening prayers. But the vast majority of what she's talking about is praying with our own words. And Mother Roman emphasized that a lot. And so I'm not trying to diminish the value of praying the prayers of the church. But, you know, they might take 15 or 30 minutes in the morning or evening or whatever. But this is really the praying throughout the day and praying with your own heart, what's in your heart. And that's the sense of really being genuinely honest. That's what the Psalter, Psalms are so good about. They learn, why do the nations rage and why do the people plot vain things? Well, I hardly ever hear, in fact, I have never heard anybody quote that to me. They come in and they're all upset about what's going on in the world and who's fighting whom and what they're the conspiracy theories and what they're, you know, the globalism and all that. But nobody comes and says Psalm chapter 2, verses 1 and 2 to me. Nobody. Zero. It's never happened in 15 years. Nobody's come and said that to me. But that's exactly what the psalmist is doing. The psalmist is saying the world's upside down. People are going crazy. And just like, read that psalm. You want to know what's wrong with the world? Read that psalm. And pray that psalm. Because that's, if you're anxious and worried and troubled about what's going on globally, that's the honest prayer to pray. But you can pray in your own words, but the psalm will teach you. And so that's true with all the prayers of the church. That the prayers of the church are teaching us how to pray in different circumstances, but we don't even notice it. And so when the psalmist says, I look to the left, I look to the right, no one cares for me, no one cares for my soul, it's, oh, woe is me, I'm so, you know, pity me, I've lived such a hard life, and nobody cares for me. And well, we have that kind of culture now, like, who can be the biggest victim? I can out-victim your story. And so, but the psalmist, that's pretty common in the Psalter. And there's a whole set of psalms that are called the complaint psalms. And Jesus prayed one of them on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? People come in, again, all the time, talk to me and say, like, God doesn't answer me, he doesn't care for me, he seems like he's left me, not paying attention to me. And I say, well, that's how Jesus felt. Well, what do you mean? Well, he prayed, my God, why? Oh, you're kidding me. But that's true, it's right there. And so it's this attentive awareness to the prayers of the church, but letting them, including the Psalter, but letting them come have an ownership of them. So we're praying with this kind of, there's a sort of brutal honesty in our prayer. And that really cuts through this kind of phony piety. I mean, if you want phony piety, well, then join the Pharisees, because that's great. That was phony piety. And, well, Jesus had some words for them. And he loved them, and he was always with them. And he said that their actions were thwarting the purposes of God for them. But that's what phony piety looks like. I'm going to keep everything at a distance. I'm going to look good on the outside and pretend about the inside. And so this brutal honesty really becomes the source for the question, Lord, God, where is the wound? Sorry, I'm just going to say, Lord, where is the wound? That's what she should have titled it, obviously. So, Lord, where is the wound? And that's probably what it is in Romanian, I guess. So here's the way it works, is that you have a garden, and there's weeds in it. Unfortunately, there are weeds in my garden already. And you go along with like some clippers and you clip the top of the weeds off. Okay, well, look at that. There's no weeds in the garden, but all the roots are there. And tomorrow, whoa, how'd those weeds get back here? You know, I go along with my clippers and I say, oh, look at that. There's no weeds in the garden. And the next day, there's weeds again. And a lot of us have that approach to sin, or to our passions, to things that are going wrong, you know, to gossip or to gluttony or to unkindness or envy or whatever it is, laziness and addictions to the internet and things like that. is that we cut things off at the top, but there's no addressing the roots of it, the things inside. And so the first way into that is when she says, "Lord, where's the wound?" She means I want something deeper down than what's just superficial. Okay. So for example, here, take something like this. So suppose you're aware that you're talkative. Okay. Suppose you're aware that you're talkative. Okay. And you go and you confess you're talkative, and you've been doing this for decades, and you're still talkative. Okay. But if you really ask, "Lord, where's the wound?" In other words, what is it that's underneath my talkativeness? What's the root to that? Well, it might be that the answer is I don't know, because you have to ask God that for yourself, okay? But it might be, for example, that you're sort of insecure about what other people think of you, and so you just take up space with words because you don't want that other people interact and talk with you. It might be that you're not running from interaction. Yeah, it might be that there's a sort of fear of love, of communication with people, a genuine fear of love. And so instead of having a genuine conversation, you just sort of fill the air with superficial content. Who knows? I don't know what it is. But the point is what Mother Sulawana is asking us to do when she says to ask God where the wound is. She's saying, I want to get down to the roots. I want to get to something underneath it. And so some of you hear this a lot from me, but what's so good about this is that it's not us analyzing ourselves. God does not need our self-analysis. We don't say, "Oh, Lord, I figured myself out, and I want to tell you about me." As if he doesn't know. Like, that's just a big mistake. But it's so easy for us to try to figure ourselves out. And when by simply asking this question, "Lord, where's the wound?" or "Lord, what's underneath this talkativeness?" or "What's underneath this envy?" or whatever it is, you know. So, what is it that's underneath this possessiveness, or not possessiveness, but like having lots of possessions? This is sort of interesting. I can use this example a little bit better. Right? So, some people have to have lots of possessions for a wide variety of different reasons, keep up with the Joneses or whatever. But it turns out that my mother always had to have like 7 cans of tomato sauce and three or four extra toothpaste, and it's like grief. Like, this is a big, we could go through Armageddon with all this stuff. Like, what's going on? And it took me the longest time, years and years, like, why are we buying more butter? You have enough butter to feed the army, you know? And it's because she was raised in the Depression. And she knew what it's like not to have anything. I wasn't raised in the Depression, I was raised in the 60s when everybody had everything. Like, it was like, totally. And so it was her way of subconsciously, kind of feeling insecure about the, there was the Roaring Twenties. She lived in the Roaring Twenties, and then all of a sudden it was the Depression of the 30s, and like, things could turn around in a moment. And so, who knows what the, Mother Sulawana is good at knowing that these things that are deep within us can come from a wide variety of sources, including our ancestors or whatever it might be, and things that happened to us through no fault of our own, or when we were children, were affected and shaped in all different sorts of ways. What's important to note is that she never thinks that knowing the origin of our problems is the solution. She never says that you need to know the origin of your problem. Sometimes she talks about it, but that's never the solution. The solution is God healing me. That's always the solution. It's always turning to Christ. It's not me trying to figure myself out. It's not even God saying, "Oh, I see what it was. I went through the Depression and now my problems are healed." No, that's not it. It's that I need to turn to Christ now in this situation. If it's the case that knowing that this arises because I went through the Depression, God will let me know that. Okay? And he'll make the connection for me. But maybe God can heal me without even me knowing what the origin was. And it might be that if I think, like, God, you have to show me what it is that's deep down wrong with me, that's just going to be a temptation for pride and self-improvement. Once I see what's inside of me, I can fix myself. God might be doing us a great favor if he doesn't reveal to us what it is that source of that wound or that origin of that wound, because he simply wants to heal it. He's not trying to make us an encyclopedic knowledge of our inner life. He's trying to bring us into communion with him. Okay? And he'll heal us in whatever way it takes. And so maybe sometimes we'll have to know what went wrong with us and what it is that the source. Sometimes we won't. But that asking of that question is the way to say, I don't want to just cut off the weeds at the surface. I want you to go deeper. Okay? And this is true with me, that sometimes I just feel kind of irritable and I don't know why. I just like, I don't know why. But I feel like if somebody comes by, I'm going to take their head off. And and so what's the right prayer? Well, the prayer that I pray is, Lord, I feel irritable and I don't know why. And I don't know if I need to know why, but I know if somebody comes by, I'm going to take their head off. And I don't want to be that way. And it turns out, I would say 90% of the time, the irritability is gone. It's gone. Why? Because I just had a conversation with God about it. And it's just gone. It might be back in 5 minutes or 15 minutes or whatever, but it's gone. And we're supposed to pray without ceasing for a reason. Because without Christ, I can do nothing. And so why is it back in 15 minutes? Because I quit praying. What a surprise. I'm not supposed to live my life alone. Christ is not changing me in such a way so that now I can be independent and I don't need him anymore. No, I'm learning to live with him constantly, day by day, moment by moment. And so it's good for my soul that 5 minutes after I prayed the irritation returns, because Christ is trying to teach me to be continually talking with him, whether it's about my irritation or about some trouble that some other person has or my anxieties about this or whatever it is, okay? It doesn't always, it could be the beauty of the day, and thank God that the sun is shining, but it's a continual communication with God. And so again, in the simplest ways, don't make it too pointed, in the simplest ways, we're asking God to shine his light a little bit further into our souls so that we can see something that we haven't seen, and it may not be so much see the content, but there's a kind of awareness of something that we're offering to God, okay? So let me put it this way. In having a conversation about my irritability, I'm thereby offering that irritability to God, okay? I'm offering God to God who I am as I am. I'm not offering a pretend me, okay? I'm offering the true me. And so if you think about it in terms of some lines from the Gospels, some of the most sobering and difficult lines of the Gospels. Jesus says at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, many are going to say to me on that day, meaning the judgment day, we cast out demons in your name and prophesied in your name and performed miracles in your name. Well, that seems pretty good. Yeah, but he said, I'll say to them, depart from me, you who do lawless deeds, I never knew you. Well, that's kind of a striking thing. I never knew you. And similar like to the five foolish virgins, they lived their whole life in this sort of monastic ascetic struggle. And they come and knock on the door and say, let us in, and he says, I don't know you. So that's pretty sobering stuff. And so you can offer yourself to God as a phony. Maybe that phony gets saved, but you don't, because you're not offering God as you truly are. And so you can be as pious as people who prophesy in Christ's name and perform miracles in his name or live your whole life in this deep asceticism. But if you're not offering to God who you truly are, then it's not you that God is coming to heal. It's this pretend person. And so this is really the need to let God's light shine, not figure ourselves up, but let God's light shine into us. And so then offer that to God. Whatever we see, we offer to God. And if he wants to show us more, we offer that to God. And so one of the clever illustrations that Mother Suleiman uses is that our mind, our inner life is like a watermelon floating in the water.
This is a little strange.
Okay. And the part, who comes up with these things? Okay. And the part of the watermelon that's above the water is what you're aware of, and the part that's below the water is what you're not aware of. Now the problem with this is I've never put a watermelon, maybe this worked out true. I had the vision in my head, it was kind of like 50-50, but I don't know how. At any rate, there's a lot more about me that I don't know than that I do know. So the watermelon's mostly submerged, and this is a little, for me, just a little ridge, small. But what she says is that you just offer to God what is, that you're aware of, the watermelon that's above the water. You don't know what's below the water, okay? You water off to God the things you're aware of, and then what happens is that God takes those over time, some little bit of, you know, communication with him, and then that allows the watermelon to come up a little bit more. Well, now that just means there's more that's in your consciousness, right? You're aware of a little bit more, that God revealed a little bit more to you, the light was shining into you a little bit more. Well, then you offer that to God, and little by little, the whole watermelon's getting eaten up, as it were, by being offered to Christ, and then eventually, well, she puts it, is that the saints, in a sense, don't have a subconscious. They're everything has been offered to God. They're completely cleared and clean, and their conscience is free. Their subconscious is totally available and open and transparent to God. And yeah, well, that seems like that's this whole process that I'm trying to suggest to you that we're engaged in, that Mother Silvana is inviting us, that all through the context of prayer about whatever it is that's really going on in our life. And so what I'd like to do is you take about 5 minutes and do something that's a little bit more content, loosely speaking content, and then we'll stop and we'll have discussion, and then we'll go much more deeper, slightly more deeper in the time that we have, into how this process works. As it relates to emotions, and she has these marvelous phrases like, I mean, emotions are the flesh of prayer and things like that. So, and the heart is hell. So we'll get into that next time. But first, just a couple of things that, in being honest, what we're doing is we're starting where we are, not starting where we wish we were, okay? And that's one of the hardest things to do in the Christian life, is to start where we are, not where we wish we were. You know, and I got that phrase, oddly enough, from Donald Rumsfeld, who said we have to fight the war with the military that we have, not the military we wish we had. Okay, so I have no particular political intentions for that statement. It's just that I realized that, oh yeah, that's how life is. We have to live the life that we have, not the life we wish we had. And it's so easy to get drawn into the life we wish we had, okay? So we all start in our own unique spot, but we all start with the same two aspects or factors to us, okay? And this is especially developed in a little bit more systematic way in her third lecture. We're all created in the image of God, and especially in Orthodoxy, but especially for the Romanians in Orthodoxy, we're created in the image of the Holy Trinity. That's strongly emphasized by several people. Father Roman emphasized it. And Father Dimitri Stanlawe emphasizes it. So what does that mean? Well, it means a couple things, but it essentially means that we're relational beings, okay? We're created for community. We're not created for isolation. We're created to love and to be loved, okay? And the image of God has its fulfillment, in a sense, in the other person. And so St. Gregory of Nyssa will say, the person of the Father wouldn't be the Father if he didn't have a son. That just seems kind of obvious, but it's like an important point. What makes the Father is that he has a son. What makes the son is that he has a father. Well, that's profoundly relational and communal. And that's how our lives are, okay? So we're created in the image of the Holy Trinity, and valued and loved and profoundly shaped, as it were, from our created origins in this way, especially to be in community with the Holy Trinity and with one another. So in Jesus' high priestly prayer in John 17, he invites us, he prays to his Father that we be drawn into the love and life of the Holy Trinity. that's the fulfillment of our life as human beings, okay? So we're created in this way. So that means we're like immensely valuable, unbelievably valuable, God. How valuable are we? So if you go to the market and the open market and you see like this nicely wood carved thing, you know, and I don't know what it is. You can make it a cross and make it sound pious, okay, whatever. So you mean the wood carving, and you ask the person, like, how much is that? Oh, $300,000. What? That's crazy, you know? And so you bargain back and forth, okay? And so you're trying to figure out how much it's worth, okay? Well, maybe you settle on $2,000, whatever. That's what it's worth, okay? That's what it's worth, okay? So now, and then so you how much are we worth? Yeah, well, God has an opinion about how much we're worth. You know what it is? How much did he pay for us? Yeah, he paid his whole life, right? He bought us. He purchased us with his whole life. So that's how valuable we are to him. There was a market. Unfortunately, we only paid 30 pieces of silver for him, but he paid his whole life for us. So the sense in which we are unbelievably valuable in God's eyes because of our being created in his image is he's willing to give his whole life up for us, okay? That's one aspect of us. We have this longing and yearning for communion with God and one another inherent into our very created nature, okay? The other aspect is that we're fallen. And in our fallenness, we prefer the creation over the creator. That's all fallenness is. That's what it means to miss the mark. Adam and Eve preferred the fig over God. It's that simple. When you prefer cheese on Friday over God, when you break the fast on Friday because you ate cheese, you just said, I prefer cheese to you, God. That's all that means. Right? I love cheese more than I love God. Okay? I mean, that means a lot because Adam and Eve loving a fig more than loving God caused a lot of problems. Right? The world's in a big mess because they prefer it. And our world's in a big mess because we prefer the creation over the creator. Okay? And so sin is a wound to the soul. St. John Chrysostom is big on this. That's a beautiful expression to how this is stated. But when we sin, so suppose I gossip about you and you think, well, that's terrible. You're ruining my reputation. Yeah, okay, that's bad. But it's nothing compared to what it's doing to my soul, right? And God can use it for good for you. Like, you can actually turn out like, well, okay, so I'm persecuted and I still love God and my reputation's ruined, but God hasn't forsaken me. And, you know, just like Joseph, you know, right? Things really went bad for Joseph in the Old Testament, but his brothers meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And so I could be trying to destroy your life, but I can't destroy your life. I can't ruin your life unless you decide, but I can ruin my own soul. And so that's what sin does. Sin ruins my soul. It creates these wounds, okay? And then it turns out that those wounds facilitate more sin, right? Because I'm trying to cover up the wounds in various ways. So she has this beautiful imagery of the genuine self, the wounded self, and the protective self, okay? And the protective self doesn't really want to have our wounds exposed. I don't want to be weak and feeble. I want to look, you know, important and powerful or whatever it is, or pious or whatever it might be. And so, but that turned out just to create more wounds, more injuries. And so the sin wounds the soul, and then the wounds tend to generate more sins. And when this goes around for a while, we end up calling it passions. And so, and we're in bondage to passions. And so this mechanism that's going on creates a deformed state of the created nature. So we, in a sense, have a created nature and a fallen nature, and we're this sort of strange mix. And so there's this beautiful phrase from Solzhenitsyn, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, of the line between good and evil runs through the heart of every man or every person. And that's what we are, where there's this strange mix, and all of our motives are impure. They're not all terrible. We're not like wretched rotten, but we're not great and pure. Right? We're just a strange mix. And everything that comes out of us is a strange mix, not necessarily equal proportions, but always a strange mix. And so we're starting where we are, and where we are is there some unique version of I long for God. I long to have this God-shaped void in me filled with God, as opposed to things of creation. and yet I long for the things of creation, okay? So there's this internal tension, and everybody's recognizing it to be Orthodox or Christian. Plato called it the civil war of the soul. That's pretty descriptive, isn't it? That inner battle, there's a civil war of the soul going on. It's common in Buddhism, it's everywhere. So like everybody's aware of this internal tension because everybody was created in the image of God and everybody's fallen, so everybody has this inner conflict. They're going to express it in different ways. That's the starting point. That's where and then here's the last thing I wanted to say about woundedness is that, so Mother Suleiman is really strong on this sort of therapeutic model. We're wound, sin is a wound, and this is very common in Orthodoxy, especially in the context of confession and other places. And two cautions about that. One caution is that the New Testament is filled with different images. One of them is that sin is an illness or a wound and we need to be healed, but another is that sin is dirtiness or impurity or uncleanliness and we need to be cleansed. Another one is that sin is bondage and we need to be set free. Another one is sin is blindness and we need to be given sight. Another one is sin is darkness and we need to be enlightened. Another one is that sin is being lost and we need to be found. And there's about 13 of these. And they're all different windows into this inner life. They're metaphors. They're not, sorry if you don't like this word, but they're metaphors, not metaphysics, okay? And one of the images is juridical. God's a judge, sin is violating the law, and what's wrong with the Western conception is that they turned it into metaphysics. And what's wrong with Orthodox, it's perfectly fine imagery to use, but it's not a perfectly fine imagery to turn into metaphysics. This is sort of locked the way the world is. And there's a big danger with turning the therapeutic model, which seems to me that some Orthodox are inclined to do, into metaphysics. By which I mean, this is the way the world really is. Instead of a window into your life, into your inner life, to offer yourself to God, I'm turning this into, this is the way the world is. Well, what happens when you do that? We get a therapeutic culture, and now there's quite a few books coming out. There's the most recent one, it's called Bad Therapy by Abigail Schreier. So I'm not endorsing these things or whatever. I'm just saying there's this whole discussion that we've created, like, what, I get the generations mixed up, but maybe it's Gen Z or something like that. But the most therapeutized generation ever, you know, like, counseling and drugs and sensitivity and parental time and like everything you can find, and they're the most mentally ill generation ever. And like, what went wrong? And because we've created this culture of victimization, that's what happens when you take the therapeutic model as metaphysics. And Mother Suleiman, I don't think, does that. She emphasizes it a little too much for me, that's why I'm bringing it up. But she has these other images, too, of bondage and uncleanliness and that kind of stuff. So you have to be really careful, I think, that there's no room in Orthodoxy for feeling sorry for yourself, for being a victim. There's just no room for that, okay? You have to be honest with yourself. Tell God who you truly are. There's no room for cover-up. Well, here's the two extremes. Pretend you're not sick at all, wallow in your sickness, okay? Both of those are wrong, and both of those will get you nowhere healthy, all right? And so I think I'll stop there and we'll discuss. Then we'll go deeper into some practical ways for how to let God transform us with them. Yeah, so comments, complaints? Yeah.
I just love how you ended this, because I read the book, and I was struggling a little bit about the therapeutic part of her, of what she was presenting.
Yeah, she doesn't give the warning that I just gave.
No.
But I'd be interested in the reaction. But when I read it, and I definitely am sensitive on this issue, I felt like never once did she allow people to wallow.
No, but I did start focusing on a lot on generations. The whole, like, what happened in my, through my generation.
Yes, yes.
And I got kind of bogged down in that.
Yeah.
Thinking, what sins were passed down for seven generations to me?
Yeah, trying to
figure that out, you know.
Right. Yeah, so.
I like that you end this out.
And I think, again, to me, it's, so I've read the book three times, and I probably need to read another three or four, but I was white bogged down the first time with that stuff, and then when I read it again, I realized that, oh, she's spending all this time talking about it 7 generations ago that caused this problem that I have, you know? But then I realized she never used it. That was never the solution. And the solution was always turning to God, and it was never the case that it mattered, just like with some of her different psychological theories about whether mitochondria or whatever, this is all way over my head. But it turns out nothing ever hinges on it.
But maybe that's our natural mind reading this, is like we want to have the answer.
Yes.
So we want to know where in our generation this trait or
sin, I think that's a trap.
And we want the formula.
Yeah, I think that's the trap. And the solution is asking God to show us what we need to know about ourselves. There's different, I wanted to make one little qualifier on that, which is I'm not talking about different methods of therapy, and there's different, you know, like, that doesn't mean that you never take medication for anything, or you never see a therapist, and if they ask you a question about what happened in your childhood, you don't respond to the therapist by saying, that's none of your business, God will tell you if you need to know. But I'm talking about the spiritual life and how it is that God transforms us and changes us, and the place that the vast majority of us are in. But there still might be, just like if you break a leg, it's good to call the your priest and ask him to pray for you. But it's also good to go to the emergency room, you know? I'm not trying to make a general comment about counseling and psychological therapy in general. But I think that from this context of spiritual stuff, I'm totally on board with you, and I think there needs to be that, that's why I brought it up, I think there needs to be that caution in reading the book, because I don't think we want to go down, she doesn't want us to go down the road of victimization. That's a dead end. And we have a lot of it in our culture now. Louise?
If I had to stop every time I ran into a problem of trying to ask God to help me, I'd never get any work done. How do we reconcile specifically continually praying verbally in this? I mean, it can be in our mind, yes, but and not in our mouth. And I know that Scripture tells us that we have to, and Father Roman always said this, make your work a prayer. So how the heck do you do that?
Well, I think that we can be aware of the destination of praying continuously, praying without ceasing, without being paralyzed by that. And so I think that the right thing to do is simply to say a prayer when it comes to mind. It's always God initiating, and we're always responding. We never initiate. It sometimes feels like we initiated, but we didn't. We were just responding. And so when God reminds us of Him, we're struggling with some project or we're irritated at this or that person, and we remember God and we say, oh Lord, thank you for reminding me of you. I'm getting a little frustrated with this person, and you love me enough to sort of intervene. And I can do that while I'm still, you know, mashing the potatoes or whatever. It doesn't slow down the preparations for dinner, and then that will just kind of dissipate. I'll go back to thinking about something else, and then God will remind me again. This is from St. Mark the ascetic in Philadelphia, and so we increase our remembrance of God over time by simply responding to when we remember Him. And then the second thing I'll say is that I think Mother Solana says this, but I might be mistaken. Certainly Father Roman said this. He always used the word feeling. But continuous prayer isn't constantly verbalizing. It's a continual awareness.
Yes.
And Puria, Matthews Green, Puria Federica has a nice illustration of this in her book on the Jesus Prayer. She says, like, suppose you, I think it's the zoo, maybe a museum. I prefer zoo, so let's say it's the zoo. You go to the zoo with a friend for the whole day. You're there for the whole day with this friend, you know, always by your side everywhere you go. you don't talk to the person all day long. It's like you're not nonstop chatterbox, but you're always aware of that person's presence the whole time. And you know, maybe, oh, look at those monkeys or whatever it is, you know, look at the chimpanzee and look at that elephant. But that awareness of their presence affects how you're experiencing the world and has occasions that it comes to verbalization. But if somebody else comes up that you long lost friend from high school that doesn't know your friend that you're at the zoo with, then you don't just ignore one of the other, say, oh, this is my long lost friend from high school, meet my new friend from Timbuktu. I don't know. And so you don't ignore the person. The way I'm saying is they're brought into your life. And I think that sense of, that's always what me struck as a good illustration. It's kind of continuous prayer is continual awareness. In the word, we say in the churches, we say, you know, let us be attentive. That's just the word for awareness. In the scripture, it's translated beware. It's 167 times, and it's never translated, let us be attentive. It's almost always translated beware. Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. That means be aware. I didn't know that till like 2 years ago. Beware means be aware. and so you can be very conversant in the language and still not have a clue what you're talking about. And we're not just aware of, we're on guard, we're not just aware of the enemies that are coming in to distract us, but we're aware of the King, the Christ. So that's what I think is it that grows in us a little bit at a time and makes us a little bit more sensitized to God being able to break in and remind us of Him when we're maybe getting on track. I don't know if that helps, but I think it's those two things. I don't beat myself up when I forget about God. St. Mark, the ascetic, really set me free on this. He said, basically, this is my paraphrase, but what can you do when you forget about God? Nothing. Have you forgot? I'd like you to tell me something right now that you're forgetting about. But you can't do it. As soon as you remember it, you're not forgetting about it. It's just not possible. Okay? What can you do when you forgot about God? Nothing. Okay? Until God intervenes. Okay? And when God intervenes, everything depends on that. You either turn away from God or you turn toward God. Either you're too busy. You prefer your anxieties and your worries. You prefer YouTube or social media. You prefer to be angry at this person or whatever it is. Or you prefer to slow down and talk to God. And if we get in the habit of doing it regularly, it's really not very time consuming. But early on, it sometimes is more time consuming because the passions are a lot deeper. And the roots grow a lot deeper. And then the other thing I could say in this context is I distinguish between, as it were, times of prayer and praying all the time. Okay? And so I call times of prayer, like your morning prayers or something like that, I call that practice sessions. I like to speak that way. How do you practice prayer? By praying, okay? But you're practicing because if you pray, say you pray the Jesus Prayer for 15 minutes every morning, okay? When you do that, you'll find out that you're not very good at it because you're distracted about what the kids are doing or what's wrong on the grocery list or why the birds are coming back so early this spring or whatever it is, you know? But the good thing about the practice session is that everything that's a distraction, or sorry, everything that comes into your mind that's not the Jesus Prayer is a distraction. When you're driving to the grocery store and the light turns red or the child runs out into the road, that's not a distraction. You're supposed to be paying attention, right, to that. So if you're saying the Jesus Prayer in the car on the way to the grocery store, it's good that you're distracted by the kid running out into the road so you don't hit him, okay? When you're in your prayer corner, everything's a distraction, it's not Jesus, okay? And so having practice times, when our total, what I'm trying to do in this, it's like going to the piano, okay? I'm not at the Lincoln Center, let's say the least, but I'm going to practice. I'm going to practice, and I'm going to practice Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, whatever it is, until I get it right, okay? And I'm going to be relentless at that. And if I do that for 15 minutes every morning or half hour, whatever it is, or morning and evening, I'll get better at it. And then in the course of the day when I'm in the battle, I'll be better at knowing what to do in that context. And so I think if we don't practice properly, we won't be in battle properly in the course of the day. You see what I mean? Okay.
Mm-hmm. So Father John, you mentioned that you have to ask for the answer from God.
You have to ask for what?
For spiritual answers and prayers from God himself.
Yeah.
Well, if you receive an answer, it happens. How do you differentiate if it's from God, not from the opposite side, you know?
Oh,
how do
I don't...
you differentiate the spirituality? Is it the right one or is it the wrong one?
Yeah, yeah. I don't think that that's really a problem. God steers moving ships, and so he's not going to let you go astray. I mean, if the answer you get is that you're supposed to go out and save the world and preach hell and damnation, it's like, well, okay, you're deluded. There's nothing I can do about that. But I'm not talking about the sort of big things like that. I'm just talking about the focus on the inner life. Like, should I be a nurse or should I be a nurse or should I be a school teacher? I don't know. God would be happy to have you be a nurse. He'd be happy to have you be a school teacher. What he cares is that he's with you. If you're going to be a school teacher and leave God behind, he's not very happy about it. But if you're going to be a school teacher and take God with you, he's thrilled. Okay? And so I think it's just a matter of the answer that we want is Emmanuel, God with us. It's not that we want to know if we should buy organic or inorganic food, or if we should read this book or that book, or if we should have this career or that career. What we want, the answer we want, is God with us.
Yeah.
That's the answer we want.
Yeah, but I mean, like you're asking something realistic, like should I make my children stay for the whole liturgy, or should I let them pray? Or play if they get tired, you know.
Yeah, and I'm 100% certain that if you pray that with all of your mind and heart, that and then you act at the moment as it seems right to you, that God will direct you and guide you. It doesn't mean you're going to be 100% right, but you'll see by experience. There's like no doubt in my mind that's true. Yeah, but again, we didn't learn to walk by taking one step. It took us months and months to learn how to walk. I don't know if you heard of the Middle Solzhenitsyn son. So I was the Solzhenitsyns, were in Vermont, and I was in New Hampshire. So I know the kids. I met the Alexander's wife once, but he'd left before I became Orthodox. But Ignaz Solzhenitsyn is a famous piano player, he's in Philadelphia. And he was married. I was at his wedding, and so I know them not really well. I'm like, we're best friends. But I asked him one day, so he's like 125th in the world piano players or junior piano players, something like that. Just phenomenal. He plays all over the world. And I said, well, how much do you practice piano a day? As well, we want to be professional Christians, not amateur, not like, you know, that's why I asked him. Well, how much do you get? He said, well, it depends if I'm preparing for a concert or not. I said, well, okay, so what's the difference? He says, well, if I'm not preparing for a concert, it's just normal time, I play the piano for about 6 to 8 hours a day. And I said, well, how much is this you're preparing for a concert? And he said, oh, 10 to 12. Yeah. And so I think that the reason we don't get the answers we want is because we want to say, Lord, what am I supposed to do with my kids? And that's it. But are you willing to pray for 5 to 6 hours a day or 6 to 8 hours a day? If it's really that important to you, do you really want to know the answer? That's how it is that God will purify you. And then you'll see that it turns out probably not to make any difference because God will be with you because you're so engrossed in that world. I mean, it may make a difference. I don't want to be a little bit, but whatever. Yeah, so I did a whole bunch of different, that all of Mother Silvana's stuff about. Can I do one more illustration and then we'll stop for a break?
Sure.
Yeah, okay, so Mother Silvana has this great stuff about listening. and the power of listening, and how, and I, and I've been saying this for a long time, mostly to myself. I mean, I say to other people so I can hear myself. The most, the greatest and best way to value somebody is to listen to them. Like, that's like, ask them a question and listen. Like, genuinely, like, I really want to know this, and listen to them. And so Mother Silvana talks about this, and she has talked about a couple different places, but this one place she says, if you're, when you're listening to someone, if you're thinking about how to respond,
you're not listening.
It's inconceivable to me that I can listen without thinking, what does this person need to hear from my wise mind? And it's just, and but she thinks there's this profound power of learning how to genuinely listen to people without an agenda, without saying, you're not responsible for them, you can't change them. She's very, talked a little bit about that next hour, but you can't change them, you're not responsible to change them, you're not their savior, you're just there to listen. And that's the kind of the gift of God to them, is to listen to them, and there's this great power in it. Okay, so this was really, it was amazing. No, it was like this piercing to me, just like really knocked me over, because I talk to a lot of people, I listen to a lot of people, and I'm talking to them in my head. And so I'll give you just one illustration. A few months ago after I read the book for the first time, and somebody called me up, and somebody I know pretty well, and she's an emotional processor, and so things are, yeah, it's okay to be, you know, we process things differently. No better to process hyper-rationally than emotionally, whatever, it's just like we're complex human beings. But I'm thinking, I talked to you a lot of times, and you've got to vent for a little while, and then I have to think about how I can help you, and I have lots of time to think about how to help you, because you're venting for quite a while. And we've been through this lots of times before. And so I'm on the phone, and I think maybe like 45 seconds into this phone call, totally predictable, like right on cue, and I'm right on cue, and then Mother Silvana comes to mind. Like, oh, there you go. You're trying to figure out what she needs to hear. Don't do that. And so it was just like, and she talked. It was about 15 minutes. I actually looked at my phone. I was like, I don't know what's up. But for me, it was this constant spiritual struggle to say, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to pray. I'm going to listen and pray, listen and pray, listen and pray. There might have been a pause where I said something or whatever. I might have, you know, but beyond politeness, I just tried to listen and pray. And this was it's a miracle. It's just amazing. Is that at a certain point, with no diminishment of the emotional intensity of all the things that were going wrong, in particular with one person, it was like she handed the phone to a different person. I mean, like, I was shocked. I mean, it's just like I was sitting, thank God I was sitting, I've got it falling over. Because it went from this high level emotional intensity to, let's call this person Betty Lou. Okay, so, and so, oh, Betty Lou's actually pretty good about blank. So, like, whoa. For the last 15 minutes, Betty Lou's been like in the doghouse. And it wasn't just the content, it was like totally calm voice. I mean, like, I literally thought, this is not the same person. And Betty Lou's pretty good about this. And Betty Lou was really helpful with it. Five, six, seven things right in a row, totally calm voice. I didn't say a word. I had no advice for her whatsoever. I had just tried to listen. Yeah. And it was a constant struggle. I mean, like, it was not easy for me because I have all this good information I have to give. And she's given me lots of time to come up with lots of good information. And so it was a miracle. I mean, I look at it, by miracle, I just mean it was like God acting, God intervened. And it's like, and I let her go on for like another 5 minutes talking about how great Betty Lou was. And then also I said, like, this is so great, so-and-so, you know, whatever her name is. And so I said, because, like God showed you that there's this, like, we're complicated creatures, we have good and bad, and we got this sort of, you know, like, that you sort of see, open your eyes, you see these beautiful things about her, and she's like, you know, this is a wonderful thing. That's all I did. I just like, rah, rah, keep it up. and conversation was over in 25 minutes. I don't think I've ever had a conversation with her less than an hour. It was like totally fine. It was like, it saved me a half hour. I like to have fun, but this is really true. It was the power of listening. And so it might be true that maybe we need to listen to our kids, like why they want to leave the church or why they're not interested and whatever it is. I'm just saying, like, there's not any simple answers here, but it's crying out to God, and in this case, as it relates to relating to other people, it's not trying to fix them, whether they're our kids, our parents, our priests, our parishioners, whatever it might be. It's this tremendous power of listening. That's enough. Okay, time for break. And we'll come back in 20, 25 minutes. We'll reconvene. Get some fresh air.